There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mannell, and I'm your host. On today's program, radio, and what's going to happen here with our FCC. My guest, Matthew Lassar. He covers the FCC and lots of media policy for the tech website ArsTechnica.com. He is also an historian and teaches media history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He is my new partner, co-blogger at RadioSurvivor.com, where to cover all sorts of great topics. You do want to stay tuned. Hello, Matthew. Thanks for joining me again.
Nice to be here again. Hey, I got to ask you, what was that?
I'm sorry?
What was that interesting introduction? That was from some science fiction movie, I guess, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand you. We were just having a little technical trouble.
Okay, sorry. In your introduction, there's an interesting intro, some kind of a reference to a movie, some kind of a science fiction movie.
Yeah, that is Man or Astro Man. It's Transmissions from Venus. It's Man or Astro Man's kind of like a surf punk revivalist band that were very active in the 1990s. That's just a track that I picked out back when I first started doing a radio show on this topic in 1996. And I like the intro, obviously, because it, it's talk about transmissions from space and then listen to a Paul, listen to the voice. So that's the intro music, and I've been using it since the pre-Media Geek days.
Wow. Well, it was a pleasure to listen to it.
Cool. So, first off, Matthew, maybe we'll talk a little bit about our new blog project here that we've been at for about a month, if that's correct, radiosurvivor.com.
And May 11th.
May 11th was when we started. Okay. And
the first time. Yes.
And I really have to credit you with being the instigator with this particular project. And in fact, I think you first bugged me about it, almost maybe 2 years ago, saying, looking for people to blog along with you. At that point, I was in between projects, so to speak, and trying to wrap some things up with my work down in Champaign-Urbana. And then you bugged me again this year, and I was ready to do it. Why don't you talk a little bit about what the idea here is, why you wanted to pursue this project in particular?
Well, radio is in an amazing period of transformation right now. It's interesting that this is the 50th anniversary, I think, of a magazine article that was published in Look Magazine in 1949. Which the title of the article was, Is Radio Doomed? And the widespread perception at the time that television was going to kill radio, and instead radio reformulated itself. It became drive-time radio. It became background rather than the foreground of your media consciousness, and that's the way it's managed to succeed again, even though television became the premier media instrument, electronic media instrument. Radio's gone through, I think, a similar period right now, and there are a lot of individual bloggers out there who write about various portions of radio, and then there are a lot of news groups that write about radio. But I don't really get the sense. I'm not really getting the sense from anybody that there is a real conscious effort of a group of people to try to figure out together where is radio going, and to try to write about that in this sort of conscious kind of way. If you you know, you go out there in the online news sphere, you find a lot of radio industry websites that are very identified with the what I would describe, and I think maybe you would describe, as the old radio industry, broadcast over the air radio, very protective of it. They're probably a lot of them, their advertising bases are very, very dependent upon that industry. And they tend to be aware of the fact that the internet and mobile phones are transforming radio as we speak, and making them into something very different and new. But they're really kind of resistant to that because their base is in good old radio stations, you know, whatever it is, 6,000 or 7,000 radio stations. Conventional radio stations that there are in the United States. So there's them. Then there's a whole lot of individual bloggers, and there's some new trade. There's some new trade journals that are coming out, and those trade journals tend to focus on streaming radio stations. But they're very attached now to the streaming radio industry. And so what you're getting is you're getting all of these different news sources that are sort of based in dependence upon one industry or another, and not a lot of news sources that are pretty focused just on radio consumers and trying to figure out, you know, what's in the best interest of radio consumers. And that's what that's why I asked you to become a blogger with me on Radio Survivor. And we also have gotten, I'm very happy to say, Jennifer Wake, the blogger about college radio. She's got a great site called Spinning Indie. It's just basically just keep track of where is everything going, and what is radio right now? What is radio on the internet? What is radio in Pandora and Flacker and all of these new venues? I don't think that a lot of what is called radio is in fact radio. A lot of it is jukebox. I think that radios, although I'm thrilled and I've got a BlackBerry and I listen to streaming stuff on my BlackBerry all the time, and I P2P and do all kinds of things out there. I don't think that a lot of that is radio. I think it's just basically streaming music. I define radio as something that is based in some locality and has live people talking to you. And a lot of that isn't happening in streaming. And I just want to bring back some standards, or at least some discussion about standards, to the enormous changes that are taking place in radio broadcasting. And I want that to happen in some kind of a context that isn't directly or indirectly dictated by some financial source. Mm-hmm. And that's what Radio Survivor really is all about. At least that's what it's about for me.
Right. And that's, I mean, I joined you in this, and I thought it was a good idea, because I do think that radio is still a vibrant medium. And I think I agree with you about your emerging definition for radio, that it is, I mean, it is an auditory medium, fundamentally and primarily. And I think that that extra something, that je ne sais quoi, is the programming, the sense that there's real selection behind it, that it is not merely a jukebox. And I think that that's, you know, in the same way, the difference between television and watching DVDs, right? In a similar way, if you had a DVD changer, it was not something which was ever very popular, but some people had them. And if you were to somehow decide to put it on random, it's different than watching television, watching a programmed stream that has been put together by somebody. And I think that there's real life left in the medium. And I too don't feel like we have to be utterly beholden to the electromagnetic airwaves and analog radio. Although I also happen to think there's quite a bit of both use and life left in this particular mode of radio. And, you know, of course, satellite radio itself is still electromagnetic as part of the airwaves, even if it is digital. And I think you're right. What has been missing to me in so much of the press around radio is a critical voice, and not critical from the standpoint of criticizing, not from the standpoint of criticizing for the sake of, but willing to examine the medium, different initiatives, and different players, different broadcasters, and different forms of the medium, honestly. So one of the things, you know, for instance, is that there's an industry journal just called Radio. Radio tends to focus more on technology. It's for, you know, it is for people in the radio industry. And on their website right now, radiomagonline.com, one of their top stories is debunking the top 10 problems with HD radio. And what it basically is a knee-jerk defense of so-called HD radio, digital radio. And it doesn't really take up, it really doesn't debunk the criticisms. And that's what you find in a lot of these publications, is that in cheerleading for radio as it is, and more really more specifically, commercial radio as it is, the status quo, the shrinking status quo, they're very conservative in their outlook, if not retrograde in their outlook. And I think that to be a fan of radio, to be someone who thinks the medium has life, requires tough love. It requires right. taking a harsh look at the way radio is and has been, and being willing to level that criticism, and at the same time, being willing to offer kudos, being willing to offer thoughts on betterment, willing to offer thoughts on seeing, you know, what the future could be, different ways of doing things, and being critically engaged with the medium. So, you know, for me, it's not to be a defender of radio, because I can't defend most of what's on the radio. But to say that it doesn't have to be this way, and we don't have to leave this behind. And because I'm convinced that just because radio listenership, or even more specifically, commercial radio listenership is on the decline, doesn't mean that the very idea of a programmed audio stream, programmed audio programming, is defunct or obsolete in any such way.
Well, I think that that's where we're going with this. And, you know, I mean, HD radio is an interesting, you know, is an interesting issue. A lot of, I mean, obviously, the biggest broadcaster in the United States, Clear Channel, is very invested in HD radio. Very, you know, unfortunate for, fortunately for it, the FCC has basically made ubiquity HD radio, which Clear Channel is invested in, the main standard, in fact, the only standard for HD radio. And so, you know, a lot of people are, you know, glomming around it, and they're, you know, they're pushing it. And there are a lot of questions that have to be asked. One is why is there only one standard? You know, why is there only one standard allowed by the Federal Communications Commission for HD radio, when in fact there are, around the world, there are different standards. For it. Why is it only one company that's basically allowed to be the main investor involved in it? I think that a lot of these news magazines are also very, very beholden to the National Association of Broadcasters, both for information, for access, and most importantly for advertising. And so they're basically going to hone to the NAB line, and I'm looking for some perspectives or a website with a group of people who can get beyond that and past that and take a look at what's going on beyond the National Association of Broadcasters. So that's more or less the idea. RadioSurvivor.com. That's the name of the blog, and we've been dealing with a lot of interesting issues. We've been you just wrote an article about this wonderful application that you can now get on the iPhone, which you can tune into public broadcasting basically through that application. And it was a very interesting article. And Jennifer's got an article. Jennifer Race has an interesting article about all the controversy over to what extent young people are still listening to conventional radio. The radio industry is very, very defensive about this issue. Apparently, there was an article in the Boston Globe about this, which quoted some young people saying that they don't listen to AM or FM radio anymore, which, by the way, as a teacher at UC Santa Cruz, that is overwhelmingly my experience with students. They do not listen to AM or FM radio. The only ones who listen to AM or FM radio are the ones who listen to national public radio, and many of them are journalism majors.
Matthew, I wanted to kind of change gears for a moment and get on to what you pay attention to the other half of your week and look at the FCC a little bit, because finally, now,
six
months into the Obama administration, we have a new chairman, a Democrat, Julius Genachowski, and yet we still only have three commissioners out of five, so they're still limping along a little bit.
There's two there's three commissioners. There's Genachowski, Michael Copps, who is also a Democrat, and who was the interim commissioner for a little while, and Robert M. McDowell, who is the lone Republican on the Federal Communication Commission at this point. He will be joined, I think, soon by the second Republican who will be on the commission. They will be the minority on the commission now. There'll be two Republicans and three Democrats, and the second will be Meredith Atwell Baker. She, a former administrator with the National Telecommunications Information Administration. And the third Democrat will be a lady named Mignon Clyburn, who is with the South Carolina Public Service Commission, and is the daughter of James Clyburn, a very prominent member of Congress, and a very prominent African-American member of Congress. So that's the lineup. The Senate Commerce Committee has, I think, voted out, approved Clyburn and Baker's applications, and I think that that's waiting now for the United States Senate as a whole to vote for it, and for President Obama to swear them into office, and I'm suspecting that that will happen relatively soon, and then there will be a full federal communications commission, and man, do they have a lot of work ahead of them. I mean, I don't even think we could, you know, if we talked until 1 o'clock in the morning tonight, we could get to all the stuff that is going on. But obviously the most important thing that is going on, or at least the most high-profile thing that is going on, is that the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act charged the FCC with producing a national broadband plan. That is to say, a plan for how the United States should improve its rather sorry ranking in the world in terms of broadband penetration. We're number 20 or 21 at this point in the United States, falling behind South Korea and Slovakia and some other places. And how do we get more Americans into the broadband into the broadband situation? That's one of the big charges that the National Broadband Plan has, and the FCC has been collecting submissions from everybody about how to do this, and they're going to have to produce a report, which they're going to have to give to Congress in February of next year. So that's probably the biggest issue. Accompanying that, parallel to that, is that the big stimulus package, which the Obama administration got Congress to pass through, although lots of people don't think it was big enough, includes $7.2 billion in money to be given to various entities to build up broadband projects around the United States. These are divided into three different kinds of things. Most of the money is supposed to go to, I guess, what you would describe as sort of middle-mile projects. That is to say, little sub-backbones built up out of fiber or whatever you want around the United States to basically extend the backbone to areas, particularly rural areas of the United States, so that more people just basically can buy internet, can buy broadband accounts. The second is centers, giving more money to libraries and schools and community centers to provide more last-mile broadband access for people around the United States. And then a lesser, even lesser amount of that money is supposed to go to basically stimulating broadband demand. That is to say, educating people, creating education projects in rural America and other parts of America where people really haven't glommed onto broadband in any circumstance whatsoever. Mm-hmm. there's a lot of back and forth and discussion about whether it's really worth it to do that and to what extent it's worth it to bring broadband out to some areas of the United States and whether that's really going to stimulate anything or not. That's another big question. But there's no question about the fact that it'll certainly produce jobs. It'll certainly produce opportunities for lots of people. The Department of Commerce is now accepting applications. I just wrote an extensive article about the conditions under which they are accepting applications. And it looks like there are going to be so many applications that, to my and many other people's amazement, the Department of Commerce is looking for volunteers to read the applications. That is to say, they are calling for volunteers to apply to the Department of Commerce to help them evaluate all of these broadband applications for broadband stimulus money. And the other group, that is the other government agency that is also taking this money, although they're going to probably give out a lot of that money in loans rather than outright, grants, is the Rural Utilities Service of the Department of Agriculture. So parallel to this national broadband plan, the first round, it looks like this is the first round of money giveaway, is happening for broadband stimulus. That's going to happen between now and September and November. I would say by November you'll see hear about the first winners in the great broadband stimulus rollout. And the FCC is going to hold a lot of public meetings about this. They're going to hold a lot of they're getting a whole big there's going to be a whole big dog and pony show over at the FCC. They're going to have a lot of public meetings. People can come and they can give feedback about all of this. What I think lots of people are finding frustrating about it is that $7.2 billion isn't a lot of money for this. That's what most people think. They think it's really not enough money. It's enough money to do something, but it's not a lot of money to really fundamentally transform the situation. But that is really the story of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Mm-hmm. And that is that lots of critics, most prominently Paul Krugman, the New York Times prominent Nobel Prize-winning economist critic, says that overall that act really hasn't gone far enough in terms of providing the kind of emergency stimulus that the economy needs. But that's where we're at in terms of broadband at this time.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of other things in front of the FCC well.
And Jenikowski is making his own things.
so what are some of the things on the Jenikowski agenda?
Well,
what are some of the things he's bringing
to the
fore?
Commerce Committee yesterday, and he's just brought up a really big bugbear, an interesting bugbear, which is the question of the regulation of digital television for children. Now, the big issue about TV is that now that we've gone through the digital transition and most Americans are watching digital TV, and there's probably about 1 billion Americans still who are scurrying around getting those converter boxes for their old analog clunkers, but I think that most of that's getting worked out. Now that we've got digital TV, we have the enormous potential of interactive digital TV. That is to say, digital TV where you can hook up your computer, hook up a set-top box, have a mouse, and alongside the TV set, you see, you click on all kinds of things. Click onto websites, click onto Facebook, click onto Twitter, click onto websites. Or you can be directed to websites on the TV shows. You're going to see a whole lot of interactive television and a whole lot of media reform groups. And these includes not just media reform groups, but the American Pediatric Association and a lot of physicians groups, the American Psychological Association, I think, but certainly the American Pediatric Association, have been saying we're really concerned about the potential of this to sell a whole lot of advertising on the web to children for junk food. As you know, as everybody knows, we have an obesity epidemic in the United States, and that obesity epidemic is hitting children very, very hard. We have a whole lot of really fat kids in the United States, and they're suffering the consequences of that, the most important of those being diabetes. And the question becomes, to what extent can this be regulated? To what extent does the Children's Television Act, which was passed in 1990 and limits the amount of commerciality on children's television, to what extent can that kick in to digital television, and particularly this problem? And in 2004, the Federal Communications Commission issued a whole bunch of rules limiting the amount of commerciality on digital television, basically extending the Children's Television Act to digital television. One of the things the Children's Television Act says is that you can't have what's called host selling. You can't have the star of the kids' show selling stuff to kids. So SpongeBob SquarePants can't sell junk food to kids.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, there's only so much commerciality that's allowed to be on what's called core educational children's television or any children's programming during the week. And there's got to be a minimum amount of educational programming, as it's called, core educational programming during the week. One of the things that the FCC did was it said, now that you've got these digital channels, which you can split off into 3, 4, and 5 streams, you have to produce, you have to provide an equivalent amount of core programming.
Mm-hmm.
The more streaming you do, the more extra channels you broadcast, the more core educational programming you have. They also tentatively said that you can't do any interactive kids television where their kids, you know, get shown websites and they can go to the website. You can't do any of that and sell kids commercials without some kind of opt-in mechanism for that parents can opt into. In other words, that's got to be there. And the content industry freaked out over this. I mean, they really just went ballistic on this. And there was a whole lot of lawsuits and everything. And finally, the FCC gave up on this. Yesterday, in front of David Rockefeller, the chair of the Senate Commerce Science Committee, and a guy who is very interested in FCC reform. In fact, he told Janikowski at his confirmation hearing, he said, fix the FCC or we will fix it for you.
Right.
He said, Janikowski said, I'm in favor of that opt-in mechanism. Now, I got to tell you right now, I don't even have the vaguest idea how that's going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how they're going to do that. You know, I'm not even sure what's the way you have this opt-in mechanism. I think that we're talking about a lot of regulation here, and I think it's going to be very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, Janikowski carved himself up a big piece of work by doing this.
Well, Matthew, thank you once again.
Thank you, Paul.
Matthew Lassar, who writes for ArsTechnica.com, covers many FCC matters, media policy, internet policy, and other wonderful things we all need to know more about at ArsTechnica.com. He's also a co-blogger along with me and Jennifer Waits at RadioSurvivor.com. Thanks again, Matthew. Appreciate talking to you. And that brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. Indeed, I'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment. Thanks to Eric Yarnell, who has been ably manning the controls and things going on here. I appreciate his assistance every single week. And the Media Geek website is at MediaGeek.net. The radio show is at Radio.MediaGeek.net. The Twitter feed, Twitter.com/MediaGeek, for the 140-character missives of great importance. And you can also tweet back your answers or questions, as the case may be, Twitter.com/MediaGeek. Comments about the program are always welcome by email, paul@MediaGeek.net. Media Geek is produced live, I tell you, live, in the studios of WNUR in Evanston, Illinois, on the beautiful campus of Northwestern University, and is carried by community stations all over North America. If you know a station you think should carry Media Geek, let me know, or let them know. It's free for non-commercial stations. Again, that email is paul@mediageek.net. Thanks for tuning in.